I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. In this episode of the Unmistakable Creative, musician, programmer, author, and CD Baby founder Derek Sivers joins us to talk about creating a life that enables you to get anything you want. Derek, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Cool. Thanks, Rennie.
Yeah, so it is my absolute pleasure to have you here because you've been long requested by many of our listeners and fans of the show just because I know the work that you do has impacted their lives in some way or another, either through your TED Talks, your books, or even through CD Baby. And you know, you've done all these sort of really iconic things like, you know, founding CD Baby and selling it for $100 million, writing these amazing books, and having this really sort of multi-hyphenate career. And where I want to start really is what the formative experiences of your life have been and inflection points that have ultimately led to everything that you're up to and all these things that you've ended up doing.
That's a hell of a first date question, huh? let's see. I moved every year. I think that was a big thing.
Uh-huh.
I've heard people, now that I have a kid, I've heard other people say, well, you know, kids need stability.
I'm one of those kids who moved every couple of years.
Oh, cool. All right. Maybe you get this. That, to me, moving every year was my normal. Like, that was just the thing to do. We've just moved every year. And I remember this moment. I still can vividly picture this. When I was 6 years old, when we moved to Chicago. And I remember asking my mom, like, so how long are we going to stay here? And she said, well, maybe 5, maybe even 10 years. Like, my lip started quivering. I went, like, the idea of, like, staying in one place for 5 years. Oh, my God, that was a horrible thought. So it's kind of funny that, you know, we did end up living there for 10 years. But sure enough, as soon as I was able to get free, like, as soon as I graduated high school, I was off to Boston for a few years, New York for a few years, and just have just been bouncing around ever since. And haven't lived anywhere for more than a couple years since then. So that's just physical location-wise. Mm-hmm. And actually, just very recently, somebody told me that that's a very American thing to do. They said, well, you know, Americans often deal with their problems by moving. And I think it's just a side effect of just this big, giant country where you're allowed to move anywhere. And a lot of people that settled there came from other places, and they moved to be there. So, you know, it's not like my friend Anna, who lives in this house in Padua, Italy, that is, you know, her family has owned since the 1600s, you know, it's just a different mindset. But mm-hmm. Anyway, so I think that, yeah, I move around a lot, and that applies career-wise too. There's this feeling of been there, done that. I read a quote from an artist, a painter that I liked once, that said something like, I like to do something until I know how to do it, and then I stop. I think that applies to things that I do.
How did the experience of moving around so much impact the social relationships in your life and the way that you run and build companies and lead people and interact with people?
The way that I interact with people, I found that ever since I left my high school, when I graduated high school, moved off to Boston, I kept in touch with friends by phone. And really, I think even in high school, I did the kind of classic high school thing of talking to my friends for hours a night on the telephone. And I still do that. Like, right now, my two best friends are in Portland, Oregon, and New York City, and I'm in Wellington, New Zealand. And there's a third one in Sweden. Yeah, actually, my three best friends. So yeah, Portland, Oregon, New York City, and Sweden. And we talk every day on the phone. Or every other day. And I think that's just very normal to me. I think other people have this definition of friendship as friendship are the people that you go hang out with and you go do things with. Mm-hmm. And say if you were to move away from your town, you'd kind of lose those friendships because you're not hanging out anymore. So I guess I've always been a remote friend. As far as companies, this is kind of new to me. I mean, CD Baby, I set up in person. I mean, it was a pick, pack, and ship warehouse business. It was very much like based in a place, though I was kind of uncomfortable with that. So about 4 or 5 years into it, I made made sure that it was autonomous, that it could just run without me. And then I went down to Los Angeles to be with my girlfriend while the company was up in Portland, Oregon, and just ran it remotely. And I guess I did that for the rest of the company's history. Yeah. I like working alone. I like being somewhere else from where everything else is.
So that's interesting. You like working alone, yet you've done these really big things that involve other people. And I'm just interested in how that works, like how the dynamic of that actually plays out, and how other people deal with similar situations. Like, I thrive entirely off of being around other people, and that's largely, I think, why I've chosen this as a platform.
Ah, okay. So I don't mind being in touch with people. So, like, my email inbox, you know, I put aside time every day to I get probably, I don't know, 30 or 40 emails a day, and I answer every single one, and I put aside some time to do that. So, like, my girlfriend, for example, thinks that I'm crazy social, but she's a professor, and she's a real introvert. So I'm definitely an introvert. Like, I like to physically be alone. Like, if I'm in a room by myself, I feel that I have, like, unlimited energy. I could just go forever. Uh-huh. The minute you put one other person in that room, it just drains all my energy away. Like, I'm just tired within, you know, half an hour. Even if I'm not talking to that person, even if that person is just, like, on the other side of a big room, just having another person around drains me. So I just love total solitude for work like that. But say, for example, my Wood Egg book publishing company that I did a couple years ago. God, I had something like a total of 130 people working to make those books. So it was a series of 16 books. Each one had 3 researchers, a couple writers, and an editor. And I just never met any of them in person. It was all just remote, and I systemized the thing. So it was kind of like a little bookmaking factory. And slotted people in, found people, put them into the slots, and people that wanted to do it. And if anybody had to flake out or take off or change their mind, it was no big deal to kind of slot somebody else in. And I'm really comfortable with those kind of situations. So I think that's the hybrid for me of a way of working with other people, but yet physically being alone.
So you've done all these things, and I guess, you know, one of the bigger questions that comes from this for me, as I'm thinking about all the people that I've spoken with and wrestling with a chapter in the book that I'm writing around mastery, like how people become masters, you've had this sort of multi-hyphenate career. And I'm just curious, like, how do you know when you've reached a point where it's time to move on to something else? And do you think that everybody is destined to have sort of a multi-hyphenate body of work, or are there some people who are just destined to be, you know, masters at one thing in particular?
I don't know. Well, let's see. That's a kind of a trick question.
I've been known to do that to people.
It's not about destined to be. Yeah. It's about, let me think for a second. Sometimes it depends just how broadly or narrowly you are defining what you're doing. Mm-hmm. So to me, writing songs, writing like copy, I guess you could call it, like writing my site, like all the communication, writing my essays, let's say, writing the blog posts on my site, and writing computer code, those three things all feel pretty similar to me. It's all just creative expression. Actually, I think writing songs is kind of a hybrid between the two. Mm-hmm. So maybe I could see why those two things grew out of it. So imagine this. When you're writing a song, especially, well, obviously, like a song with lyrics, then your lyrics are successful based on how well they are received, right? Like, if you write some lyrics and, like, nobody has any idea what you're talking about, or they completely misunderstand you, or they just generally don't like the lyrics, then you've kind of failed at those lyrics. Unless your only mission was to just scratch your own itch and you didn't care about anybody hearing it. But for the most part, your lyrics are successful if people get it and they like it. So I think it's the same thing with writing essays or writing copy, writing the text on your website, or writing articles or writing a book even. It's all about how well it's understood. You have these thoughts in your head and you're trying to get them into someone else's head, right? Mm-hmm. So if you do that well, you've succeeded. But then the other half of music is the music itself, kind of putting this all together and taking this sound or this idea in your head of this music or this song you want to write, and having to go through some skills in order to make it happen, whether it's finger dexterity on an instrument or recording studio dexterity to make the sounds you want to make. That to me feels kind of like programming. I have this idea in my head of a website or some app that I want to exist, and now I've got to type out the right code and wrestle with it and figure out how to turn that idea in my head into reality. So everything I'm doing to me kind of feels like one big thing. Hmm. It doesn't feel so multi-hyphenate until somebody is asking me, you know, like if I do a blurb on the back of a book cover and somebody's saying, oh, how do you want to be credited? I'm like, oh, I don't know. Just say Derek Sivers. Do you know what I mean? That it all feels like one big thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I do. I mean, my work has taken on a number of different forms, in the form of producing events, producing books, and producing this podcast, although the podcast is sort of the primary one, but it seems like it had all these sort of extensions that I never planned or predicted.
Right. Now, imagine this. Different people have different reasons for what they're doing.
Uh-huh.
So some people may start a company because they want to make a lot of money, and that's their main goal with that company, just make as much money as I can. That's why I'm doing this. Other people, their goal may be to leave a legacy. You know, I want to do this company. I want to say, you know, the classic Silicon Valley thing of measuring your impact on the world. I want to change the world. I want to have a big impact on the world. And that's how they would measure the success of their project, their company. But someone else, and this is my example,
mm-hmm.
May do things just for the doing, like just for the curiosity of seeing if this is something you can do. Almost kind of like it's more of a personal development reason for doing things. Like, I want to see if I can start a book publishing company, or I want to see if I can make this little idea happen, or I want to see if I can learn a new programming language and do all of the programming myself without asking for any help, or, you know what I mean? Like,
mm-hmm.
That may be the personal challenge. And that's what I was actually doing with CD Baby. And even with Wood Egg, honestly, both of those things were just scratching a personal itch. That was just something that I wanted to see if I could do. It was like a puzzle I wanted to solve. And so when people would come to me saying, you know, you could make a lot more money if you would do such and such and such, we should consider going for an IPO. Let's get some investors involved. We could really grow this thing. And that was completely lost on me. I had no interest in that at all because I wasn't doing it for the money.
Uh-huh.
In fact, getting other people in to lead my company or even hiring other programmers would have made the whole thing moot for me. Like, CD Baby, I did all of the front and back end programming myself. There were no other programmers. It was just me. And that was why I enjoyed doing it. If you were to suddenly bring in a team of programmers, I would just lose all interest and just shut it down because there was no reason to do it anymore. Same thing with even making music.
Uh-huh.
For 10 years, I was this full, maybe 15 years, I was a full-time musician. And I insisted on playing all of the instruments myself and singing everything myself. And every now and then, like, a well-meaning producer would listen to it and say, you know, you really should just get a different singer. You're just clearly not a singer. Just get a better singer. And I'd say, no, out of the question, because that would just lose the whole point of why I'm doing this. I'm not doing this in order to have the best final product. I'm doing this in order to practice my singing and see if I can improve as a singer. That's the reason I'm doing this. If other people like it, it's just a side effect. But my primary reason for doing any of this is the personal improvement aspect of it.
Okay, I love this. You're speaking my language, and I think this is really going to gel with people. You know, I knew you'd probably take us down this direction because I read on your website, you said, you know, one of the main reason you do anything is for intrinsic motivation. And I've always found this to be one of those things that is very complex to understand, because we can understand something like what you're saying very intellectually, but it's a lot harder to internalize. And I remember Danielle Laporte told me, in an interview, she said, your art can never be about the money. And my response was, yeah, that's easy for you to say. You're Danielle Laporte. And yet when I finally got that, a lot of things started to change. And I guess, you know, I'm interested in how people sort of find their way to their own intrinsic motivation, if that makes any sense.
Well, I think we all start out there.
Yeah.
If you see a kid playing with Legos, you're like, why are you doing that? What is the ultimate goal? You know, mm-hmm. it could be a much better castle if you were to have somebody else do that. You know, you're like, I'm playing with Legos. Like, nobody would say that to a kid. You understand? No, he's enjoying playing with his Legos.
Yeah.
So I just feel the same way. Like, I'm doing this because I enjoy it. And I think people get – a lot of it, I think, is money driven. You get this kind of like necessity and fear. Like, I need money. I need lots of money. What's the best way I can make a lot of money? I can make this big company. And then we can get some other – we can make a lot more money if we get with these investors. And then the investors will give us some money. And we can make more money that way. And if you get really, really driven by that stuff – then yeah, it changes all of your further decisions. This isn't play anymore. This is work. This is serious. We need the maximum return. And well, now I've got investors, so uh-huh. I need to give them the biggest return for their dollar. Otherwise, they're going to be upset and give me grief and whatever. But I think a lesson I learned way early on, my very first long-term girlfriend, when I was like, I don't know, teenager, 20 years old, she grew up in this hippie family where they grew up in a commune in Vermont with no electricity. She never had a TV. She grew up with almost nothing, but yet, and her parents didn't have jobs. They just did random little odd jobs. And yet they were able to put her through college just because they kept their cost of living so low that they could just do whatever they wanted. Just doing random projects were enough to pay for their cost of living. And that was a huge influence on me. So although I did get a job straight out of college, I got a job in the tape room at Warner Chappell Music Publishing in New York City. I kept my cost of living so low. So I was earning $21,000 a year salary, but I kept my cost of living down to $12,000 a year just because I spent nothing. I was just renting one room in a house with three other guys. I spent no money on anything. I never even took a taxi. I would spend hours just waiting for the subway because it would save me $4 or whatever. But I kept my cost of living down to nil so that after 2 years of working there, 2.5 years of working there, I had saved up $12,000 and I quit my job. So honestly, Srini, that was the last time I had a job. It was 1992. Mm. I quit my last job and I've just found a way to live cheaply ever since so that I could have the freedom to just do whatever I want, not need to do things for the money.
Hmm. Okay, so this raises a ton of questions, specifically around the internal narratives around money. I mean, it's such a complicated issue that raises, you know, some real emotional hot buttons for people, you know, myself included. And it's interesting because, I mean, you went from that position to selling a company for a seriously large amount, and then not only that, donating all of the money. So I'm interested in kind of how your internal narrative around money and wealth has evolved over time. And why do you think that so many people struggle with this? And more importantly, how do they start to change it?
Oh, boy. let me actually, you know, if remember the second half of that question, because I'm going to forget it.
Okay.
In a second. I'm going to just talk about the first half of your question. That I kind of – okay, when I was a – full-time musician. When I was like doing the hustle as a full-time musician living in New York City, and the way you do that is you just say yes to everything. Somebody says, hey, we're looking for a heavy metal guitarist for this recording session. I say, yep, I'm a heavy metal guitarist. Count me in. What does it pay? And somebody says, hey, we're looking for a jazz piano player for this art show. Like, what does it pay? $350. Yes, I'm a jazz piano player. Count me in. And then I just quickly go practice piano and learn some basic jazz enough to get paid. And that's how I made a living as a full-time musician. Even bought a house with the money I made touring. So to me, that was like the measure of success as a musician, as a professional musician, is that I was able to make my living doing it full-time. But then I really enjoyed reading books on sales and marketing and applying those lessons to my music business, right? So I would get a call from a university saying, hey, we're looking for a solo acoustic performer for August 12th. Are you available? And I'd say, probably. You know, it depends on what you can afford because I've got to travel to get there. They'd say, well, we can only afford $300. And I say, oh, sorry, I can't do it for anything less than $500 because such and such. And they'd say, well, that's really the best we can do. Our maximum budget is $400. I say, okay, well, I can do it for $400 if you're able to help me contact some of the universities next to you to line up some gigs the day before or day after. Then I could do it for $400. And they'd say, okay, sure. And I'd hang up the phone like, yes, I did it. I made an extra $100 and I'm going to book two gigs now instead of one. And I'd get such a sense of achievement out of having done that. And the money was definitely part of that. It was like this neutral measure of success. Like I got $400 instead of $300 for that gig. It was easy to measure, right? So what's funny is it wasn't selling my company that got me rich. It was actually CD Baby was quite profitable on its own. I think it was making a net profit of about $4 million a year, and I had no investors. I was the only owner. So already just, you know, 4 or 5 years into it, I was making enough that I could just retire right then if I wanted to, assuming I keep my costs of living low.
Right. Really.
But there was a little bit of sadness around this. For the most part, like when I was just deep in CD Baby, it was just completely intrinsic. I wasn't doing it for the money. In fact, I barely ever looked at my bank account. It's just like a couple times a year I would look at my bank account and go, wow, that's bigger than I expected. Cool. I wasn't even really keeping my eye on the money because I was just busy, you know, making CD Baby what it needed to be for its own sake. Right? Mm-hmm. So there was a little bit of sadness, though, around missing having that clear measure of success. I missed getting excited about getting that extra $100 for a gig, you know. And I remember actually I've talked with a couple famous musicians about this, but they say that is one of the downsides of getting rich and famous is they kind of miss that, the hustle, the joy of like booking a gig and getting 20 people to come down to a club or whatever. You kind of, you can miss that aspect later as it grows. But all it means is that you really have to just start doing things for completely for intrinsic reasons or other reasons. Sometimes people turn their attention to charitable reasons. You know, how many am I able to help create a school in Cambodia or something like that? Like that can motivate them more than, you know, earning another $100. But yeah, all that said, making a lot of money is fucking awesome. it's a wonderful security. It's pretty amazing then that like once you've got that covered, you know, Maslow's pyramid of needs, once you've got that covered, you can just turn your attention to the other stuff and no longer really ever do anything for the money again, which is actually kind of a hard habit to break.
Yeah. So let's talk about people and their internal narrative around money. Like, do you think you've got to get to that point of selling something for that much to get the, like, well, actually this is the bigger question around this.
Okay.
Can we shift the narrative so that the circumstances change?
How do you mean circumstances?
So let's say that you're not where you want to be financially and a large part of it is driven by your internal narrative around money. Can you shift the narrative that you're, you know, the dialogue you're having with yourself around money and your relationship with money so that the situation financially changes?
Good question. I mean, clearly, yes. I mean, you kind of knew that answering, asking that question. You knew the answer is yes.
Yeah, I know the answer is yes. I want to know how. And I'm wondering, is this actually just isolated to certain individuals or are some people just destined not to ever be rich?
No, we each have things that trigger us in different ways. So I remember years ago reading a Tony Robbins book where he was trying to motivate the reader by saying, imagine all the things you could buy. Don't you want to have your own helicopter? Don't you want to buy a private island someday? Imagine driving your brand new fancy sports car. And I remember reading this just feeling like, nah, that's all lost on me. You know, that does nothing for me. Whereas I know some other people directly that are very, very influenced by this idea of like, I'm going to work extra hard or I'm going to focus on adding value to my customers or I'm going to create the best customer experience because I want to buy a Ferrari, you know? And it's not shallow. There was even an interview with the Beatles once, I think like a couple years after they broke up in the 70s. an interviewer was interviewing Paul McCartney, and he said something like, you know, people like to glorify the Beatles and thinking that we were all just peace and love, man. But he said, no, when John Lennon and I were writing those early songs, we would sit down and say, let's write a swimming pool. Let's write a song that is going to earn us enough money to buy a swimming pool. So it was definitely motivated by money. So it's, you've just got to know what works for you, right? So to me, it was the freedom, this idea of earning enough to feel free, to not have to do anything for the money, which clearly from, you know, what I told you was pretty easy for me because I was able to keep my cost of living down to like $1,000 a month.
Right.
So if I was able to do just even a couple gigs in New York for, you know, a few $100 each, then I had earned my monthly cost of living, and everything on top of that was just extra, you know? So obviously, you know, there's this big thing, like you can keep your cost of living way low so that it's nice and measurable. But on the other hand, if you read Richard Branson's autobiographies, he was driven by the sense of desperation. He would get himself into a jam somewhat intentionally. He'd always go down to the last wire. Like, he would borrow a ridiculous amount of money from the bank, spend it all and everything, get himself into a jam, and then be forced to do some kind of big money-making gamble at the last minute in order to get the bank back their money by the, you know, tomorrow when it was due. And a lot of his growth was driven by that sense of desperation, whereas, you know, that wouldn't work for me.
Yeah.
So anyway, you talk about the narratives we create. I don't think anybody can just hand you down one and say, this is how you need to think about money. You'll just listen to lots of different people talking about money and motivations, and then you'll find that one clicks for you, one works for you.
Yeah. It was interesting. It reminds me of a conversation I was having with a friend of mine the other day. And, you know, I'd just gotten back from a surf trip to El Salvador. And I said, you know, it's really bizarre. I said, you know, when you boil it down, I said, my motivation for everything that I've gotten to do, write books with a publisher, produce the show, I said, you know what? The whole motivation right from the beginning was designed so that I could surf whenever I wanted to.
I said,
that was the ultimate motivation. It trumped everything else. And all the other things, like you said, are just sort of byproducts. But that one thing has always been so consistent that I was just like, I'm willing to do whatever I have to in order to make sure that I have the ability to do that.
Wow. That's a great thing to realize. You know, it's, and sometimes you can only find that out through experience.
Oh, yeah. I've lost sight of it at times. I've definitely lost sight of it at times.
You know, that's why I don't think we should ever regret our bad times in the same way that we shouldn't regret our bad relationships. You know, like so many people that you date early on, that you're together, your long string of girlfriends or boyfriends or whatever, each one is teaching you what you don't want.
Yeah.
You break up with that person, you go like, never again will I be with somebody who does that. And I think as you go through life, that's how you learn what you do want, is by a long string of realizing what you don't want. Hey, on that note, you brought up the fact that most people think is weird about how I gave everything away, or I put everything into a charitable trust when I sold the company, therefore kind of giving it away in advance of selling it. So that to me just came from this aesthetic I have of understanding the word enough. I really like knowing what's enough. So this even comes down to like personal decor, for example. If you look at my house, there's almost nothing in it. It's only what I need for me and my kid. I don't usually tend to entertain guests. In fact, I pretty much almost never have more than one person over. So, for example, I only own two plates because that's enough. I don't need eight plates because I never have eight people over. I don't want eight people to come over. So I have two plates. That's enough. And I only own one pair of pants because can't wear more than one. And so things like that. Like I really like understanding the word enough. And so by the time I sold, or by the time I was selling CD Baby, I already had a few million dollars saved up, and that was enough for me. That was enough for the rest of my life, assuming that it's just conservatively invested and I'm just living off the interest and not touching the principal, then that's enough. And I spent a few months thinking, what the fuck am I going to do with $22 million? And I realized that all of the ideas I was thinking of were violating my aesthetic of enough. It's like, I don't even want the $22 million. You know, all I'm really going to do is give it away. And so it's when I talked to my lawyer, who was also a friend and just somebody who got me and was a good guy and also had a tax law background. When I described to him that I was just going to give it all away anyway, that's when he said, well, you know, if you really, really mean that, like you're sure you are never going to change your mind on that, there's something you can do where you can give it away in advance. And so that's why I did that. It's like by giving it away in advance had a few psychological benefits too. So the tax benefit was, instead of me earning $22 million personally, then paying $7 million tax on that and really only having $15 million left to give away to charity, by giving it away, giving the company away in advance of selling it, meant that all $22 million goes to charity and never touches my hands. This also had a psychological benefit because I would never have this sense of regret, like, ooh, I should have just, maybe I should have just bought a Ferrari first and then give it the rest away, or, you know, or even just having, you know, $15 million sitting in an account with my name on it might have been dangerous in a lifetime, you know, if I get depressed or something, I might go do something stupid. So I really liked the fact that it took it out of my hands, so I didn't even have it to spend, you know.
Huh. So can we bring about these psychological benefits even in small ways, like in our day-to-day transactions with money?
Oh, God, yeah. That's what's brilliant about reading these books about behavioral economics, like Predictably Irrational.
Mm-hmm. We've had Dan here before.
Oh, good. Okay. You read Predictably Irrational, or you read Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman. And there's a whole series of these books, Stumbling on Happiness, The Paradox of Choice.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them are around the subject of behavioral economics, which are learning about the faulty wiring in our brain and then ideally setting up your life in such a way to take advantage of or protect yourself from your faulty wiring.
There's more of my conversation with Derek after this short message from our sponsors. Today's episode is brought to you by freeshipping.com. Saving money when you shop online doesn't have to be complicated. Scouring the internet for discount codes and other things can be really time-consuming, and half the time the codes don't even work or have been expired. I've wasted a ton of time myself on things like this. But with a subscription to freeshipping.com, you can not only shop at a bunch of the retailers you already know and love, but you get 10% cash back, free shipping, and free returns. And you get the 10% cash back on top of other coupons and savings. You get free shipping rebates without a minimum order amount, and there's over 1,000 retailers you can choose from, including Best Buy, Walmart, Target, and Lowe's. And you can buy just about everything, including clothing, books, electronics, and more. So you can save at all the retailers you normally shop at and even discover new ones. So let's say you want to buy a high-ticket item like a PlayStation, a home appliance, a computer, or a television, or even a refrigerator. You get free shipping and 10% cash back on it. And for being an Unmistakable Creative listener, you'll get $15 in a free trial to kickstart your savings. So go to freeshipping.com/creative. That's freeshipping.com/creative to start your savings with $15 in a free trial. Now, back to my conversation with Derek. Can you give us a tactical example of how we might apply this in just sort of a day-to-day transaction?
Let's see. I think paradox of choice is quite popular. So we all know this idea of having some choice is good, but that doesn't mean that having more choice is always better. And when you read and understand that message, you realize that you don't have to give yourself the maximum number of options. In fact, you're happier if you do what they call satisficing instead of maximizing. That if you, when making a decision, you say the phrase good enough a lot. You know, like, this car is good enough. I don't need the best possible car that's available to man. I don't need the best possible computer. I just need one that's good enough. Believing that can, and really internalizing that and understanding that can save you a lot of money.
Hmm.
There's also this, the book Stumbling on Happiness. Sounds like it's new agey, but it's not. It's written by this professor of psychology at Harvard that's been studying happiness for decades. And one key finding is that when people buy some new thing, the happiness it generates is actually only in the moment of comparison, where you're comparing your new thing to your old thing. In that moment, yes, you are happy. But once you've had this new thing for a while, and it might only be a week,
mm-hmm.
you're no longer comparing it to your previous thing anymore. It has now just become your new normal. And the happiness from that item fades away because you're no longer comparing it. So if you really understand that, then there's no need to buy every new iPhone just because you hear of all of its benefits. You understand that, like, I could go spend $1,000, you know, even if it's whatever subsidized through my monthly payments, you know, add it up, it's still coming to $1,000 or something. I could spend $1,000, but it's really only going to make me happy for a week. Is that worth it to me? Or, you know, people who spend extra to fly business class or first class, and it's like, well, how much is 6 hours of happiness worth to me? Because the moment I get off that plane, I mean, I get there at the same time as the people in economy, so am I really going to spend an extra $4,000 to be happier for 6 hours? I don't know. You use these kind of behavioral economics questions, understanding and realizing that the studies that have been done also apply to you.
Well, I think that actually makes a perfect transition to something else I want to talk about. And I think this just will be kind of an interesting deep dive into how you spend your days. You know, one of the things you said on your website is that you're fascinated by usable self-help. And I actually really appreciated that because I felt so often that so much self-help material is just a bunch of inspirational psychobabble that doesn't translate into actual results for people. And what they end up doing is just becoming addicted to self-help. And I love that idea of making it usable. So I'm just curious, you know, why is so much of it unusable, and how do we translate it into something usable? And how have you translated it into something usable in your own life?
Well, most of it, I think, just is a way of thinking that makes people feel better, right? And that's totally valid. Like, mm-hmm. I've got nothing against that. If you've had some very difficult things happen in your life, and you are able to read something that helps you reframe that stuff that happened to you in the past in such a way that it makes you feel better about it, then that's great. And I think that's maybe why people become addicted to it, is because while reading that book, like while the author's words are still kind of echoing in your head, written in that beautiful, inspirational way, you feel so much better in that moment. And maybe you feel better about your future. Maybe it's you're reading something that is inspiring you for the future. And in that moment, you're reading that, you're filled with a sense of hope and optimism. You feel really good about it. And then you finish the book and you go to sleep and you go back to work the next day and you don't change anything. And you're like, oh, I kind of miss feeling that good. I'm going to read another book. And then you read another book. You're like, ah, yeah, see, I can do anything. I can be anything I want. The world is mine. This feels really good reading this. And it's done, and the feeling fades because you just go back to doing the same old thing. So, I still have to say, though, that that's valid. Sometimes you really do need to feel better about things that have happened in your past. I definitely had that with, Pema Chodron wrote a couple brilliant books that that made me feel a lot better just thinking of things that had happened to me in the past that were like really annoying me, like still kind of stuck under my skin. And I read something by her that just made me go like, oh, wow, that's a really nice way to think about it. That feels really good. And I don't know if I actually changed my actions in that moment. I think it felt really good. And I made my peace with this like thing in the past. One thing you can do, by the way, to solidify these is, I think that's what's so great about blogging, is that when you take something that you've recently learned and you share it in that moment, especially if you share it publicly in a real way like that, you internalize it more. It becomes part of your self-identity. Like, see, I've blogged this. This is who I am now. Like, this is a part of my public self, therefore my real self.
Yeah. You know?
So that's a good way of internalizing a way of thinking about something. As far as actions, yeah, that's, I wish more authors would, give directives like do this. I don't know the most recent, blog post on my site, at least as of now, as we're talking, is where I announced this kind of new project I'm doing, where I felt like, now that I've read 225 books in the last few years, a lot of them with these really interesting observations about life and psychology and whatnot, most of them don't want to take that extra step into telling you what to do about it. They just leave the reader up to their own devices. Like, well, here's some really interesting observations we've had about the way the world works. So hope this is useful to you. Good luck. You know, most people don't turn it into something. Uh-huh. Whereas there was this paragraph that had a huge impact on me in this book about Stoicism called A Guide to the Good Life, where he said, back in, you know, the days of the classic Stoic philosophers, they would tell you what to do with your life. Like, if you were to ask one of them how can I live a good life, or how should I live my life, they would tell you, here's what you should do. He said, I get the feeling that today, if you were to ask a philosophy major, philosopher, what should I do with my life, they'd say, well, depends what you mean by do. It depends what you mean by life, and it depends what you mean by my. You know, and they would just talk in circles all around this thing. You just never get to the simple directives of saying, do this. You know, I think of the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments were not there to discuss all of the various issues. They just said, no, do this, don't do that, don't do that, do this. Uh-huh. I think there's something powerful about prescribing an action that, in fact, I think the action kind of carries the philosophy inside of it, kind of like a seed, like those trees that, you know, their seeds go fly in the wind, and it carries the seed inside of it. So the philosophy is carried inside of the action. So you can just give the action, and you're kind of prescribing the philosophy inside of it at the same time. Huh. So I wish more books did that. And so they don't. And so a new project I'm just barely starting, I'm not even sure what form it's going to take, it's this idea of taking everything I've learned from the past however many years and however many books and turning it into specific actions to prescribe.
So one of the things this raises, and this is something that I have asked a lot of people, and I still to this day, I wonder if I get an answer to this question because I'm asking it or because it's a universal experience. I'm curious, you know, throughout this whole trajectory of yours, have there been any sort of rock bottom, dark night of the soul, like no hope for the future moments?
No. I'm really lucky that when I was 19, well, no, I'm lucky that when I was like 16, my grandma had a book on her shelf called How to Win Friends and Influence People. Mm-hmm. And I read that and it had a big impact on me. And I'm lucky that I was an ambitious 16, 17 year old wanting to be a rich and famous musician. And I saw a little book called, W. Clement Stone was the author's name. I forget the name of the book now, but just one of those like classic 1930s self-help books. And I just, you know, devoured it when I was like 17. It just really internalized its lessons. Then when I was 19, my boss at the circus, I worked in a circus for 10 years. I was like a ringleader MC of a circus.
Wow.
And my boss at the circus really cared about me. And she said, you know what? I read this book called Awaken the Giant Within by Tony Robbins. I think you'd really like it. And so, oh my God, Srini, when I read that at 19, it just floored me. And I read it again and again. It just totally internalized everything he was talking about. I read it again when I was 20, again when I was 22, again when I was 23, and just listened to everything he put out and all of his interviews with other people and really just internalized those philosophies. So much so that things that were very deliberate at first, such as like a classic Tony Robbins line is, whenever anything bad happens to you, you have to ask yourself what's good about this or what's great about this. And I remember like the first time I heard that, I was like, yeah. You know. Second time I heard it, I was like, yeah, okay, maybe. And then next time something bad happened to me, I didn't remember to do that, of course. But then like the next day, I was like, oh, I probably should have asked myself what's great about this. And then next time something bad happened to me, maybe it was like a few hours later, I remembered to ask what's great about this. And eventually, like over years, now it's just like this kind of instant reaction that the very second something bad happens to me, I just catch myself saying, well, what's great about this? And therefore, I don't ever really get beaten down by things. You know, I'm just in the habit of finding a useful aspect to it immediately.
So you work in the circus. That is really interesting. I'm curious, what kinds of lessons did you bring, you know, from working in a circus into all the work that you've ended up doing throughout the rest of your life? Like, what did you learn from that?
The way to entertain a crowd is to make it all about them, not about you. I think when I was 18 years old and I got up on stage at the circus with almost no performing experience, you know, I'd been a musician for a few years, but hadn't been a great entertainer, really. I was really bad at first. And then my boss at the circus and the whole crew there, like, kept pushing me to, like, no, you've got to, like, be more entertaining, be more like, you know, you got to, come on, these people are looking for entertainment. Don't just get up there and fucking stare at your feet and be a navel gazer, you know, like, put on a show, give some pizzazz. And so, you know, it took a long time for me to finally understand that lesson. And I did it. I mean, I did over 1,000 shows over the next 10 years and got a lot of experience in how to entertain a crowd. Especially, you know, if you can entertain a crowd of 4-year-olds, you can entertain anyone. It's kind of funny when later I was performing at universities across America and did the exact same tricks that I learned for captivating a crowd of 4-year-olds. It also works on 20-year-olds. But the bigger life lesson learned is that if you want to entertain an audience, this is about them, not you. You can't just get up there and just talk all about yourself and dive too deeply internally, unless you're also going to do the masterful work of kind of finding a way to dive deep and make it entertaining to others. But to me, it's always top priority to make it about other people. So like, pretty much everything you see on my site on sivers.org is just, I'm doing that for others, really.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about some other component. You know, you mentioned a website. Something that has caught my attention, and I've seen it sort of echoed, and I know this came from you, was this idea of if it's not a hell yes, it's a no. And mm-hmm. where that came about, how it's impacted your life and how it might impact ours, and, you know, how that ties into this whole idea of anything you want. So multiple questions in one, I realize, okay. Which I've done to you multiple times already.
So the hell yeah or no philosophy says it's when you're feeling overwhelmed, overbooked, there's too many opportunities and not enough time, then you should beware when you're just feeling like yes about something. Like if somebody says, like, can you come speak at our conference? And if internally you're feeling like, I could. I mean, well, the good thing is, you know, well, okay, they'd pay for my travel to San Francisco, and okay, well, I could also see my sister. So yeah, I guess I could do that. I guess it could be beneficial. My point is that should be a no, because when you're overwhelmed, if you're feeling anything less than like, oh, hell yeah, that would be amazing. Mm-hmm. If you're feeling anything less than that, then you just have to say no, because end up filling our lives with this like little tiny crap that we've obliged ourselves to do. It just fills up all of your time so that you don't have enough room in your life for those big hell yeah things that come along rarely. But on the other hand, if you said no to all the stuff that you felt merely yes about, mm-hmm. then when you get the occasional kind of like, oh, hell yeah opportunity, then you can just let it like fill up and expand. You've got lots of room in your life to dive into those things. So this has worked really well for me, but I have to emphasize that it is a technique that applies only when you're feeling overwhelmed, when you have more opportunities than time, right? Mm-hmm. When you're starting out and you have more time than opportunities, then the correct strategy is to say yes to everything. Kind of like I was saying earlier about being a professional musician in New York.
Right.
Like anytime anybody has a paying gig of any sort, even if it's not a hell yeah kind of thing. Like, you know, my very first paying gig was like $75 to play guitar at a pig show in Vermont. Mm-hmm. And it was like a $60 round trip ticket to get to Vermont. But I said yes, because it was like my first paying gig, and you got to say yes to everything, because every little tiny thing you say yes to can lead to more opportunities. So point is, we need to learn to change strategies along the way. So yeah, if you're starting out and you have more time than opportunities, just go say yes to everything. Go to Craigslist and just say yes to a bunch of stuff on there for people asking for help. Go go make yourself available to the world and say, I'm here to help anybody do anything. What do you need? You know, whatever it is. Like, just do everything. Like, chase every opportunity. And only later, when you're overwhelmed with opportunities, you've got more, you know, more money than time, then you can start changing strategies and apply the hell yes or no approach.
Wow. Well, Derek, this has been fascinating, as I expected it would be. So I have one final question for you, which is how we finish every interview. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Unmistakable. I was thinking about that word before we got on the phone. That I'm assuming that if you interpret mistakable as the ability to be mistaken, or as able to be mistaken, kind of like the word misunderstood, then to be unmistakable, you must be very clear and unambiguous. And it reminds me of one of my favorite bits of advice about writing, that someone said, the key to good writing is not to be understood, it's to not be misunderstood. That's the bigger challenge. People are very likely to misunderstand what you're saying unless you're very clear. So what makes someone unmistakable, I guess, is to be very clear in your own head and in how you're living according to your beliefs. You know, be very clear, unambiguous, makes you unmistakable.
Well, I really, really appreciate you taking the time to join us and share your story and your journey and your insights with our listeners. This has been great.
Thanks, Rini. And yeah, anybody who, if you made it all the way to the end of this interview, I mentioned earlier that I actually enjoy putting aside a little time every day to answer every single email I get. So anyone, feel free to email me at derek@sivers.org. Introduce yourself, ask me anything, and I'm happy to help.
Cool. And for everybody listening, I'll be sure to link up all the books that Derek mentioned in the show notes, along with some of the blog posts we've talked about. And we will wrap the show with that. If you like what you heard, the greatest compliment you could give us is to share the show with a friend and let people know what you think by leaving a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening to The Unmistakable Creative.